Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Episode 3 of Leibniz, Gottfried Leibniz, a philosopher in the mid-16-something-rathers to early 17-something-rathers, a German philosopher. A key philosopher, along with Kant, one of these German super philosophers. So you've got Descartes, who moved and gathered a movement around him. Leibniz, a little bit less slow, and so he's someone who's sort of been missed by mainstream education to start off with. So had a very much classical Aristotelian, Platonic view of the ancients. That's what was available. The early stages. So he sort of missed the start of the Enlightenment and then quickly caught up. But from that he got some very early beliefs. One is that you start off with, as your first line of logical argument, is God exists, and therefore God exists, you can work out what things have from that. And that's very much in the scholastic tradition. So the scholastic tradition is a Middle Ages form of study, where you have scholasticism. That's scholastics. You believe certain books are correct, and if two books contradict each other, that's insight into how you must change your mind such that both are correct. And that's the sort of peak of scholasticism of the Middle Ages would be St. Thomas Aquinas, Summa Theologica. And then as you've added more classical stuff into scholasticism, you eventually have the ignition of the Enlightenment. There's other things like maths coming in. Now Leibniz is a monadist. So the monad is something from Pythagoras, which is basically the initial number concept. And it's drawn as a dot with a circle around it. And it's also sort of the basics of classical physics, i.e. that there is such a thing as a point. And people often think about points and think about infinity. So there's a lot of maths associated lurking with Leibniz, even though it's, well, he's like the father of calculus. So his deep thought really sparked up thought there. There's also the story of how Leibniz and Newton feuded, and when his master Georg became George I of England, we find out that Leibniz was left back in Hanover. So it gives you an idea of how unacceptable Leibniz is in the Anglo-Saxon world. We wouldn't even let him in into our world, the actual real character. We wouldn't let him, which is rather sad. He's also in the tradition of these librarians, which are popping up all over the place. The librarian which caught my sort of the Library of Alexander is very interesting. Libraries in the ancient world, but this is the anti-pope librarian. I can't pronounce his name. It's A something or other. Anastasia, I can't pronounce it. But there's an anti-pope librarian. And what's interesting is that Leibniz is also a librarian. It's a pretty amazing thing. Now, we've done episode three, which went through, I can just barely remember, there's six principles, two ancient principles, the principles of, I don't know what the principles are, I should go back over it. Then there's four other principles. There's a PII, which is, I'll just go back over it. So just wait here, you may as well. There's the principle of continuity. A principle of the identity of indiscernibles, whatever that means. I sort of understand it. It's sort of like mucked up quantum mechanics. Principle of sufficient reason, whatever that means. Oh, there must be an effect. Principle of contradiction, that things can't be true or false. Principle of predicate and motion, things must have an origin. They're sort of like formalization of ancient philosophy. Principle of the best, which is the principle that, which is sort of, I don't know whether that's actually one of his key principles, but it's his idea that God is perfection, so God wouldn't actually produce a second-rate world, therefore the rest of my logic follows. So what's interesting is that obviously in the cold, hard world of quantum physics, some of his assumptions of non-identical particles, like electrons or protons, and he was against atoms for that very reason. Very interesting from a physicist's point of view. And I don't know how Newton fares in this area. Both these people are not modern intellectuals in a modern sense that they have a coherent piece of work. Newton has his Principalia, his main book. They point out that Leibniz only had a series of, he had no central work, he just published into a central idea. Which is also what Newton does in terms of, he has a central work, but his central ideas of calculus, he actually doesn't address. It's sort of this modern introspection, hasn't yet sparked up. So they've got these, various principles, which, are hard to really think. I probably have to think about it a bit well. And we've got this section 4, metaphysics, a primer on substance. So we've read sections 1, 2 and 3, a general introduction, his life, 3, the fundamental components of his philosophy, which are broken into principles, which he's going to bring into together. It's also interesting that Leibniz slips in between Descartes, who's got a sort of quantum view of space, and Newton, who's got an absolute view of space. Sort of God is looking in on a little toy model. So God's got a clock, and the toy model's going ahead. It's outside observing. It's hard to actually understand how Leibniz fits into this notion. But metaphysics, a primer on substance. This is a quote, I believe. I consider the notion of substance to be one of the keys to true philosophy. For Leibniz, a fundamental question of metaphysics, was reducible to the question of ontology. What is, so this is the actual thought, ontology. What is there? What is, are the most basic components of reality? What grounds what? So at the moment we build, to answer those questions, we build the CERN super collider and do field theory, but in this case this hasn't started yet. So all of the questions are really good. In certain cases, his answer remained constant throughout his life. Everything is composed of or irreducible to simple substances. Everything is grounded in simple substances. So this is sort of like the ancient elements without atomism. While evidence appears to have given slightly different accounts of the precise nature of these simple substances over the course of his career, there are many features that remain constant in his mature philosophy. Leibniz always believed that a substance had a completely individual concept, and that was essentially an active unity endowed with perception and appetition. So this is a sort of a derivation of as Aristotle causes, that he had the four causes, which is the form, if you imagine the a three-dimensional mesh, which the object is filled, the matter which fills it, the cause for which it does, and the cause for what it's used. The other causes are hard to understand, but they're causes you need in a rhetoric framework. So there were objects were necessarily objects as defined by rhetoric by Aristotle, and you can see this coming a little bit ahead by saying that a substance has an individual concept associated with it. This is sort of bizarre. It's 4.1, the logical conception of substance in number 8 of the, volume 8 of the Discourse of Metaphysics, volume 8, my Godfather. Leibniz gives one of his most important accounts of the nature of individual substances. He claims that the Aristotelian idea of a is that which is subject of predication and which cannot be predicated of something else if insufficient of true analysis of the nature of the substance. Okay, that's pretty much, so it is obvious that he's following the Aristotle view, but he's now saying something different. He claims that Aristotle's idea is what is that which is the subject of predication. So this is predicate, this is the things which are needed to think about it, and which cannot be predicated of something else, if insufficient for a true analysis of the nature of substance. Whatever does that really mean? I sort of half get that. I don't quite understand it. He next appeals to PC. Whatever is PC? Gosh. It's full of contradiction. So, if something, it can't be true and false at the same time. And the principle of, PIN, which is the principle of predicate and notion, that everything must have a sequential cause. In every true predication, the concept of a predicate is contained in the concept of its subject. Gosh. Since this is so, Leibniz claims, we can say that the nature of individual substances or of a complete being is to have a notion so complete that it is sufficient to contain to allow us to deduce from it all predicates of the subject to which the notion is attributed, which is sort of really the fundamental law of physics. Now, like if I've got an object, I can get all the attributes of it. But it's a rounder way. It's a, sort of like fundamental, object-oriented programming, almost. In other words, X is a substance if and only if X has the complete individual concept, CIC, whatever that means, that is, the concept that contains within it all predicates, past, present, and future. The CIC then serves to individuate substances. It is able to pick out its bearer from an infinity of other finite created substances. That is, this is him trying to think basically through quantum mechanics that one electron is not the same as another electron, which is true, but they are indistinguishable. It's pretty hard to understand that. The CIC then serves to individuate substances. It is able to pick out its bearer from an infinity of finite created substances. Leibniz gives an example, Alexander the Great. The concept of Alexander contains being the king, being a student of Aristotle, requiring Darius and Porus, and so on. Now, quote, God seeing Alexander's individual notion, or haecity, again, another word which I don't know and I will forget about to look up, sees in the same time the basis and reason for all predicates which can be said to be truly him. Leibniz's invocation of the Stoicist notion of a haecity is intriguing, so I'll really have to know what that Stoicist and haecity is intriguing. What Leibniz is telling us is that Alexander's thisness is determined by some of qualitative properties. Moreover, we can see a metaphysical aspect to this logical conception of substance. To be a complete individual concept of a substance is the notion or essence of the substance as it is known by divine understanding. And so this is why, this is if you don't do atoms, you're left with, it's got to contain concepts and you've actually got to bound, it's like a database. Leibniz concludes, so I have to understand what haecity, whatever that word means. Leibniz concludes this selection with a celebrated doctrine of marks and traces. Quote, when we consider carefully the connection of things, we say that from all time in Alexander's soul, there are vestiges of everything that has happened to him, and marks of everything that will happen to him in, and even traces of everything that happens in the universe, even though God alone could recognize them all, which is really true about what I think this is true. Well, I think this happens to social or cultural reality, that someone lives and they die, but their soul lives on in the acts and how they're remembered ever so faintly forward. So I really do see this as a view of a soul. The doctrine of marks and traces therefore claims that because of CIC, which is of individual concept, oh dear, that something has to have a concept to be individual, contains all predicates true of past, present and future, the entire history of the universe can be read, if only by God, in the essence of any individual substance. Okay, well, there's a lot of maths in that. The consequence that Leibniz draws from the logical conception of substance and doctrine of marks and traces are remarkable. In the following section, number 9, of the Discourse of Metaphysics, volume 9, we are told they include the following. 1. No distinct substances can resemble each other completely and be distinct. Well, I have to tell you, as a quantum physicist, each electron is absolutely, and each proton is absolutely identical. A substance can only begin in creation and end in annihilation. Give that one a tick. A substance is not divisible. Mm-hmm. Well, one substance cannot be constructed from two. The number of substances does not naturally increase and decreases. Every substance is like a complete world and like a mirror of God, or the whole universe, which can be expressed in its own way. So really, he's talking a bit about set theory, infinite sets. A number of substances cannot naturally increase or decrease, which is the count of an infinite set. A substance is not divisible, so yeah, there's a lot of set theory in there. Unfortunately, Leibniz's reasons for drawing these consequences are not in all cases obvious. Why would PII, which is his principle of identity of indiscernibles, whatever that means. No, that's his thing of why quantum mechanics is false. Why PII would follow from the complete individual concept of the count of substance? If we consider CIC, which is complete individual concept, as which allows us to pick out, individuate any individual substance from an infinity of substances, then we realize that if the individual concepts of two substances, A and B, do not allow us or God to distinguish the one from the other, then the individual concepts are not complete. So he is really thrashing about before set theory in quantum physics, that there must be must always be a reason found within the complete individual concept of substances and issuing from the free decree of God that A is discernible from B. And the fact that points to another important fact about the interpretation suggested above. It's not only the case that each substance has a complete individual concept, the essence of the substance as it exists in the divine mind, but every substance essence or complete individual concept. There is one and only one substance in a world. Yeah, it's all stabbing around the place. It's like not knowing it. And he's almost, I think that's got the conservation of mass might be in there. The argument here is essential that, which is given above in the section describing the relationship between PSR, which is principle of sufficient reason, and PII, which is the principle of identity of indiscernibles. You can imagine how thick this is going to be. Hang in there, audience. You know what? I'm just reading down the page. He's got infinite sets and subscripts. Okay, namely, what reason could God have for instantaning two substances with identical CICs, whatever the CIC stand for again? Complete individual concept. Oh, God. further, why should it be the case that substances can only arise naturally in God's creation of a world and end in his annihilation? Wow. If one takes quite literally Leibniz's claim that the CIC, that is, complete individual concept, contains within it all predicates true of past, present, and future, then one might be able to say that this must include truths extending back to the creation and forward, either indefinitely or to the end of time. Which is sort of, like, amazing. Okay, so he says that because an electron exists, I can actually think about that electron, and that electron has properties of my perception. Yeah, I think there's pretty interesting there. This argument might be somewhat weak if in itself, but it certainly would seem to follow from Leibniz's logical notion that of substances and one of either consequences, namely that each substance is a mirror of the entire universe, which is, you know, not allowed by information theory, but in this case, like, it's sort of like shrinking the problem that if you shrink something down, the information goes out and it actually burns. So one of the problems, say, with Ant-Man, you shrink Ant-Man down, you know, something down, shrink ray, it would increase in heat because the information and energy has to go somewhere. So this is, it's just not mathematically right. If in this case, then a substance, insofar the mirror of the entire universe, must have it within it the complete concepts, predicates, and extend back to the creation and forward of time, which is to do with mathematics. At first glance, it's not already readily apparent merely from CIC that the doctrine of Marx and traces why a substance cannot be constructed from three substances or divided into two new substances. Let substance X within the complete individual concept of predicates.
Yeah.
Sorry for this interruption. Out here in Australia, we've just got rid of our head of state, the highest office. We got rid of it. It's on the news, and so people called me over to have a look at it. We're in the process of reading through Leibniz, and he's got some ideas, reasonable ideas, concepts of that would be informed by a simple quantum mechanics experiment. Simple physics experiments which are going to come out. And you can see for me, the interaction between philosophy and science and maths. And he's got various statements which read very much like set theory, which is going to be developed in the next couple of years. Now, in that sense, I don't have the view that he's wrong and someone else is right. I think it's just part of the setting up of the overall problem, you know, posing the problem. And he's gone from the entire view that that God exists, and therefore from that you can make all these deductions. It's a fundamental thing. So let a substance X with its complete individual concepts, predicates, GHI, which are true in the past, present, and future. Suppose X was divided into X alpha and X beta, subscript beta. Okay, it's looking like set theory to me. One imagine both new substances would have all the pre-divisions, predicates in common and unique predicates thereafter. But the relevant part of Leibniz's logic notion is in the CIC. I'll just have to re-memorize what that is. Complete individual concept is sufficiently rich to allow us, or God, to deduce that all predicates past and present and future. Leibniz's implicit suggestion is that pre-division predicates would not allow the logical deduction of branching divided substances. Again, this is just set theory as far as I can see, but it's also relevant to quantum mechanics resolved now to information theory. If GH and I imply L alpha, M alpha, N alpha, they cannot also imply L beta, L, M beta, N beta. A similar argument works against the possibility of fusion of two substances. Further, if one already grants PII, which is the principle of the identity of indiscernibles, then it should be clear that a substance having within its CIC, which is the complete individual concept, predicates GHI, L beta, M beta, N beta, are numerically distinct substances and not simply one substance in the pre-division phase that has multiplied. Since substances can only naturally arise during God's creation of the world, and since substances can't undergo fusion or fission, it's obvious that the number of substances must remain constant. Finally, if in this case it's not of the nature of the substance to have a notion so complete that one can deduce from its all predicates past, present, and future, if substances exist from the creation of the world, then it would seem relatively natural to conclude that each substance contains within it a kind of story of the entire universe from its own particular perspective. While more will be said below, what Leibniz is suggesting is that there is a set of documents that he will develop in greater detail. The world's apart doctrine, the mirroring or expression thesis, and the doctrine of universal harmony. So this is just so interesting. So this is behind so much of our confusion at the moment, the many worlds and stuff like that. And basically, what is information theory? You know, everything is, in fact, information, and information gets more disordered, and you've got the off-axis Hamiltonians leading to chaos, in that you cannot predict the future, in that it becomes mathematically impossible to predict the future due to chaos. There's sort of so many interesting aspects that we've discovered, but it's such a good point to go forward, and of course, spawn from this is calculus. Another notable consequence of the logical conception of substance is the denial of causal interaction of finite substances. This is clearest in the primary truths, where a very similar argument concerning the nature of substance is given. Not only is this the case, Leibniz claims, that genuine substance, that genuine physical influx, the transfer of some property within one substance into a second property, is inexplicable, but more important, the logical conception of a substance shows us that the reasons for any property that is a substance may have already been contained within its CIC. And CIC, again, is a complete individual concept. So it's a set of concepts associated with it. It's sort of like Aristotle being pushed into modern science. It's pretty amazing. In other words, every state of a substance is explained, grounded, or caused by its own notion of CIC. Of course, the ground or reason for existence or actuality of any particular substance is to be found in God and his free choice of worlds. More detailed account of Leibniz's view on causation is available in the entry Leibniz on Causation. As we shall see below, the denial of causal interaction of substances forms an essential premise of Leibniz's arguments for the pre-establishment of harmony. So I'm not sort of just take this out of a filing cabinet, chuck it out the window. I think this is very interesting because it's gives you the real deep fascination people have, or well, I have, with quantum mechanics, in terms of that it does, you know, your Millikan's Orlov experiment, the spectra, does actually provide you an insight into what all these big answers. So you have to understand this is in the world before science, and he's just I think one of the interesting things is that you have to actually believe that you are on to write something to do years and years of work. If you did actually take an academic view of your own work, you'd diffuse. So there's a number of things which I think would diffuse his work. One is that if he had to publish it in a book altogether, and if he was actually allowed to travel in Europe and speak with people, that would diffuse it. Also, if he had to actually compare it to modern experiments hadn't occurred yet, which is really interesting because his questioning got people to try to examine it, which got the person Ørsted in Sweden to look at needles moving with current, and that sort of eventually led to modern science, that simple one, discovery of electromagnetic force. 4.2, unity. Oh God. If the finite substance is to have a complete CIC, complete individual concept, a body of data associated with it, which contains the entire set of data about the universe, amazing. As Elizabeth claims in volume 8 of the Discordance of Metaphysics, so this is sort of the classical view that you can know things infinitely finely. You know, you can actually, there's no Planck's constant, there's no fuzziness at the end of the rainbow, so to speak. And you can't have chaos and all this type of stuff. What is the ontological status? That is the theory of knowing. That is, what kind of thing could such a CIC or such have such a CIC or such a nature? So another major thing is that if it contains everything, you could theoretically program it something infinitely small to have an infinite amount of information. I love that. What is Leibniz's answer to this question brings to the fore another paradigm of substancehood, unity. Okay, so substancehood is indivisible, and every point has an infinite amount of information in it, obviously, because every point has the entire history of the entire universe put into it, but you just have to know to ask the right questions. Is its nature of an individual substance to have CIC, which is, what is it, complete individual concept, which is infinite amount of information, only a genuine unity can qualify, as a substance. What? Leibniz expresses his position in a letter to Arnold in a very clear, forceful manner. I'm going to read it in a forceful German manner, but you can imagine. To put it briefly, I hold this identical proposition, differentiated only by the emphasis to be an axiom, namely that, and this is where he's forceful, that what is not truly one being is not truly one being either. So, what is not truly one being is not truly one being either. Well, that's very deep, poor Arnold. Don't get offended. In the period of the Discourse of Metaphysics and the correspondence with Arnold, Leibniz appeals to certain scholastic notions, chief among them the notion of substantial form. This is where scholasticism is just, you know, it's like there's no experiments going with no verification. It's all, here are the books, just work on those books. Stoicism and all that sort of stuff. Okay. Certain scholastic notions, chief among them the notion of substantial form. In later years, this classic way of speaking fades away, but the fundamental idea remains the same. There must be something that guarantees or makes it possible for unity of a substance. And this is a substantial form of the soul. This is really interesting. And what the Buddhist is saying is absolutely true of our perception of human consciousness, I would say. Okay. The point Leibniz wants to make is that only a soul or a substantial form is the kind of thing that can be said to have or underlie a complete individual concept. For only a soul or substantial form is by its nature imperishable unity. Leibniz makes this point very clear in another letter to Arnold. A substantial unity requires a thorough, indivisible, naturally indestructible being, since it's notion includes everything that will happen to it, something which can be found neither in a shape nor in a motion, both of which involve something imaginary, as I could demonstrate, but which can be found in the soul, a substantial form or model of what is called me. So there's like scholasticism. If what happens is they've got this engine and it's connecting things together, and everything's connected to God. Eventually they get to God and they ask questions about God. It's pretty amazing. Thus, unity is the hallmark of a genuine substance, but equally important, deliberate sparagant case of a substance, the self. This thought underlies much of Leibniz's reflections on the nature of substances and important consequences. For, following not only Descartes, but also the entire Augustine tradition, the I is essentially immaterial, a mind or a soul. This is Descartes, mind and matter. Augustine, I'll have to really read into that. That's really interesting about Augustine. Similarly, he writes in Primary Truths, quote, something lacking extension is required for substances of bodies, otherwise there would be no source for reality or phenomena or a true unity. So this is a Descartesian view that things are extended into space. But since atoms are excluded, no, you can't have atoms because I can't have it. What remains is something lacking extension, analogous to the soul, which they once called form or pieces. So this is, he's actually said it himself. Because I don't believe in atoms, I've got to now just construct something of this huge edifice of concepts which violate the information theory. Material atoms, as advocated by Democritus, is in the classical period, by Gassendi and others in the 17th century are excluded. Leibniz thinks because they violate PII, which is principle of the entity of indiscernibles, which is absolutely correct. They do violate it. They do, because they are absolutely identical. That is, two purely material atoms would seem to be qualitatively identical yet distinct, which is impossible if one accepts PC, which is the principle of contradiction, PSR, which is the principle of sufficient reason, and the derivation of PII, which is atom. This is amazing stuff. He has said, I refuse quantum mechanics, therefore I refuse atoms. And he's done this in a really roundabout way. So I think it's a very valid thing that if you have God, you can't have quantum mechanics at the same time, as far as I can see from his reasoning. Leibniz's not clear as, is not as clear as one would like him to be, for at this point in his career, it is possible to read him as seeing that something is a substance so long as it has a soul or substantial form, whereas later in his career, it seems more clearly to be the case that the only substances are soul and soul-like entities, the monads, which is really interesting because he's going, monads are the mathematical points of Pythagoras. So look up on the internet, a monad is a circle with a dot in it. It's crazy stuff. In other words, Leibniz can be interpreted as advocating, at least in this period, a kind of Aristotelian high-low morphism in which substances are composites of matter and form. This has been the subject of debate in the field, but this entry cannot adjudicate the matter. Well, I think science, computers can identify the fact of quantum mechanics can do. Nevertheless, in declaring that a substance is necessarily indivisible, Leibniz renders it impossible for a body or matter alone to be a substance. Gee. Thus, Cartesian corporal substances, the essence of which is simply extension, cannot be exist as a substance. Yeah, so what I like is Cartesian corporal extension is so close to a wave function, it's not funny. Put differently, Leibniz, and of course, they have no idea of it, so it's my interpretation of the saying. Given what I know, and given I don't have the prejudice of saying Newton is the most fantastic person, given I don't subscribe to the current way of saying something, I'm free to say, well, that's, you're wrong. You've got a bit of a semblance for something in there. Put differently, Leibniz's argument is that nothing is divisible as a substance. A Cartesian chunk of matter is divisible. Therefore, a Cartesian chunk of matter is not a substance. At this point, this is the point. So you have to understand that Cartesian matter is so close to a is quantum, like all space is filled with the matter. There is no empty space, which is absolutely true. An electron has got electron wave function. Well, let's draw it. Where do you finish the axes? Minus infinity and plus infinity. An electron exists throughout the entire universe in quantum mechanics. A Cartesian, this points to the first part of Leibniz's critique of the Cartesian mentioned above. Namely, according to Leibniz, Cartesian matter fails to have unity required for a genuine substance. Indeed, in the correspondence to Arnold, Leibniz considers the case of the human body deprived of the soul and said the body, or cadaver, would not be a substance at all, but merely an aggregate of... substances. Moreover, anything lacking a substantial form or soul is not a substance. That is, if it is a thing is not truly animated, then it is only a true, phenomenon. It should be noted how strong Leibniz's claim is. He is arguing that Cartesian corporal substances, or such as chunks of matter, are not real beings, at least not as real as simple substances. Aggregates of simple substances, therefore, have a different ontological status of simple substances. There you go. You get in so much trouble. You can see him getting so much trouble if you say, God, 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 therefore not quantum mechanics. Okay, the distinction between simple substances and aggregates becomes an important one in Leibniz's philosophy. To Arnold, he writes the following quote, "I hold that philosophy cannot be better re-established and reduced to something precise than by recognizing only substances or complete beings endowed with true unity. Together with the different states that succeeds one another, everything else is only phenomena, abstractions, or relations." If this is the case, then aggregates of simple substances are merely phenomena and fail to have reality of the underlying simples. Further, the bodies of natural philosophy, the bodies of the world we observe around us, would seem to be, in some sense, mere phenomena. Ah, dear. While some scholars of Leibniz thought have suggested this, it does not get at the full story of Leibniz's metaphysical system. The distinction that Leibniz draws is one between real unity and phenomenal unity, as he puts it, and between unum per se and unum per aggregatum. So, unity of aggregates. Leibniz's favorite comparison, in this case of the latter, is a rainbow. Bodies, for example, fail to have intrinsic unity, but we do represent them as being a single unified objects, much as we represent a rainbow as being one thing when it is in fact merely a result of refraction of light through innumerable water droplets, as discovered by Descartes. Which is interesting. So I think he is actually more thinking about the way that we actually form objects in the brain rather than actual real objects outside there. But such a rainbow results from a presence of genuine unities, the water droplets, to continue the metaphor, even if it's not true when speaking with Leibniz in a metaphysical rigor. So do the bodies of the natural world result from genuine simple substances? Put differently, simple substances ground the phenomena of bodies in which substances, in which Leibniz means when he talks about, quote, well-founded phenomena. Phenomena bene fonda. But insofar as the bodies of the natural world are well-founded phenomena, that is, insofar they are grounded in simple substances, they are not simple phenomena as in Berkeley's philosophy. The view is not uncontroversial. Compare Leibniz with Berkeley and see the entry on Berkeley. Oh, God. Berkeley, so it's Berkeley. That's another, the philosophers never, ever end. The second part, it's interesting that both Leibniz and Newton are absolutely incensed by Descartes. He, Leibniz has picked up that Descartes has actually contradicted the existence of God very subtly, and Newton has spent days and hours doing experiments to disprove him. So Descartes really is an amazing fire in the belly for these people. And the second part of Leibniz's critique of the Cartesian doctrine of corporeal substances relate to the notion of activity. According to Leibniz, substances are not only essential unities, but also active. As he says in the opening lines of Principles of the Nature of Grace, a substance is being capable of action. But Cartesian corporeal substances, as far as the essence of extension, can itself be a source of activity. So when I say source of extension, I sort of read very early idea of wave function. There are at least two strands of Leibniz arguments from this point. First, Leibniz holds that it is so because he adheres to the classical scholastic idea that actions pertain to suppositia, that is, so whatever suppositia is, that is, only something that can be subject to predication, can be active. The only true unities can be Cartesian, existentist stuff cannot, insofar as it's infinitely divisible, constitute suppositium, or subject to predication. But, second, Leibniz believes that something is active, if and only if it is the source of activity, can arise within itself. That is, if only the activity arises spontaneously from itself. This is another reason, then, that individual substances will be understood as mind-like, for Leibniz believes that only minds or mind-like things can originate or alter their modifications. Well, again, this is because he just rejected atoms outright. In saying that substances are essentially active, Leibniz means that they are endowed with forces. More precisely, according to Leibniz, the very substances of things consist in a force or acting upon or being acted upon. That is, each simple substance is endowed with what Leibniz called a primitive, active, and passive powers. The ideas here again sound Aristotelian. Again, and it's also really interesting to see how Descartes handled Descartes, Leibniz, and Newton. I'll have to do an essay on that, trying to work that out. A substance has a certain essence, essentially active components, a soul, or a substantial form for first entelechy, E-N-T-L-E-C-H-E, whatever that word means, and a passive component, primary matter. In Leibniz's mature account, the primitive active force is, quote, an inherent law impressed by divine decree. That is, the law of an unfolding, or the law of a series of simple substances. He puts it in a letter to De Volder, quote, I think that it is obvious that primitive forces can be nothing but internal strivings, tendia of simple substances, striving by means of which they pass from perception to perception in accordance with certain laws of their nature, and at the same time harmonize with one another, representing the same phenomena of the universe in different ways, something that is necessarily arise from a common cause. So this is really the Greek thing. A stone falls because it's from the earth and it wants to get back. It's got a reason for it. A soul in it. You see emotion, soul. Motion. Motion and motive. Yeah, I'm motivated to get out of bed in the morning. I'm motivated. I have motion put into me because of my soul. Simple substances are minds. Their modifications are representation of perceptions. The activity of simple substance will relate to change or succession of perceptions. One to think of this is that each substance has a unique series of perceptions programmed by God to play harmony with all other substances, and the internal tendency of substances to move from perception to perception is the active force, or what Leibniz calls the appetite for appetition, or appetition, calls appetite or appetition. So this is the logical belief of ancient thinking. He has really not broken through. He's understood Aristotle in a really fundamental way, that things, smoke rises because it's like a cloud and clouds are in the sky. It's a sort of that fundamental, you know, like a little kid walking along. Daddy, you know, tell me about the rabbit fence. Oh, it's a really long rabbit fence because it is. It's sort of everything's got an initial explanation that's given to children is because that's the way the world is. And that's essentially, where science has gone forward. So you can see it's a very useful thing. I can't see how it fits in to it, but it's sort of like Aristotle. Newton was criticizing Descartes from the front, but not very far in front with natural science to get his stuff. And he, in fact, swept up some Aristotelian views of absolute space and stuff like that. But then Leibniz is attacking Descartes from the other side, from ancient thoughts. 4.4, pre-established harmony. While separate entries detail Leibniz's account of causation, his account of the mind, it will still be useful. And it's interesting that Leibniz had the mind, and so Descartes had a very mind in terms of his own mind, development of the mind, and Leibniz believes that all things are animated. So a rock has a mind in it, a soul in it. Okay. It will still be useful to provide a short exegesis of Leibniz's celebrated solution of the mind-body problem, which Leibniz had inherited from Descartes and his followers. The problem, briefly, is this. The mind is essentially thought and nothing else. The body is essentially extension. Then how can the mind and body interact to form a unity as we know the form of experience? Yeah, which is really what Descartes was saying about extension. Or how do thinking substances and extensive substances unite in the substance of a human being? Leibniz answers this question by first denying the possibility of causal interaction of finite substances. In this way, Leibniz undermines Cartesian dualism because it takes as a premise the idea that the mind-body interaction is to be explained by the influence of one or the other via the pineal gland. What? The pineal gland. I believe the pineal gland is this tiny little gland it's a pine cone shaped pineal gland. I do remember it. It's small in the brain, and I've been lucky enough to pick up a real brain. That's a real honour to do it at the Mind Institute down here in Western Sydney. And underneath it is this tiny little pine shaped gland. And let's read that one again. Leibniz undermines Cartesian dualism because it takes as a premise the idea that the mind-body interaction is to be explained by the influence of one on the other via the pineal gland, which is a pine cone gland. Wow. That is thoroughly weird. But so there's a pine scope sitting dangling beneath your brain is a tiny little gland shaped like a pine cone. Why? How does that get in it? But Leibniz, so airy fairy has finally got that in. But Leibniz also saw pre-established harmony as an account of the mind-body relation that avoided difficulties inherent in the occasionalist theories of the mind and interaction of substances. In one of Leibniz's best-known metaphors, he asks his readers to imagine the mind and body as two pendula hanging from a beam. What? Wow! Let's love it, because I love capital pendulum. Whence comes their agreement? One could imagine that the motion of one is communicated through the wooden beam to the other, thus causing eventually the swing harmoniously, theory of influx, or one could imagine that God intervenes and moves the pendulums, guaranteeing their synchronicity, the theory of occasionalism. Well, Leibniz says, one could imagine that God, the supreme artificer, created the world and the pendulum so perfectly that by their own natures they would swing in perfect harmony. Naturally, this is the last thesis that Leibniz and Dawes's, and asks his reasons on Dawes as well, which is essentially what Newton says. Newton says the laws of physics are what God says, and God has put them these laws of physics. Newton was just excluding God's law. But I love the technical pendulum. More precisely, Leibniz argues that God created the world so perfectly that each substance acts according to its own law of unfolding, and is at the same time the perfect harmony with all other substances. Further, the mind has a distinct point of view of the world by virtue of being the center of some mass or body. The law of unfolding, and the law of unfolding of the mind is accord with the laws of corporal machine. He puts this most succinctly in his 1695 essay. Great. Have you read the latest essay? It's from 1695. A system of nature, in which he effectively presents a five-step argument for the pre-establishment harmony. Here we go for five steps. Are you ready for it? I like these steps. I just recently read a Japanese invasion of Malaya. Every once in a while he goes, we're going to do a six-step plan. There are 11 components to beat the Aussies here. Okay, let's read it here. Five steps. One, there is no real influence of one created substance on another. Alright. Which is what is really behind the workings of Newton. God originally created the soul and any other real unities in such a way that everything must arise from its own depths, fonds through perfect spontaneity relative to itself, and yet conformity relative to external things. I should mention that there is this goes very much with the German theory of cell theory, which believe that things were spontaneously just working together, cells working together. I've just got to really think about it. Three, this makes every substance represented the whole universe exactly and in its own way from a certain point of view. It makes the perceptions and expressions of external things occur in the soul at a given time in virtue of its own laws, as if the world apart, as if there existed only God and itself. Four, let's just push on here, let's not stop. The organized mass in which the point of view of the soul lies, being expressed more closely by the soul, is in turn ready to act by itself, following the laws of corporal machine, at the moment when the soul wills it to act without disturbing the laws of the other. The spirits and blood then having exactly the motions that they need to respond to the passions and perceptions of the soul. Five, why not stop at four? Five, quote, it is the mutual relation regulated in advance of each of these substances of the universe which produces what we call the communication, and which alone brings about the union of soul and body. And I just really think there's a series of Germans which came basically up with cell theory, the predication of cell theory based pretty much on this. I've just got the Greek philosophers, I really can't remember any of them. Now, when Leibniz speaks in metaphysical rigor, he denies the underlying premise of the Cartesian dualism. Body is not a substance, so there can be no question of how it, qua substances, interacts with or is related to the mind or thinking substance. Good one, Leibniz. You've eliminated it by saying, begone, body is just a figment of imagination. Okay. Nevertheless, Leibniz is also able to express his view for the vulgar, that is, for those expecting a Cartesian metaphysics, by saying the mind and the body can be said to form a union and interact insofar as the mind follows its laws, the body follows its laws, and they are in perfect harmony. So he's saying that there is a mind and there is a body, alright, but they just happen to be walking side by side. It's like the mind is deb reckoning just enough to work out what the body is doing. The body and soul are not united to each other in the sense that Descartes has suggested, but the perceptions and appetitions of the soul will arise spontaneously from its own stores and will correspond to the action of the body as well as the events of the world, which is really basically it, because you do have a construction of the world going in your brain. So I think this is actually true in a certain sense. In other words, while the perceptions, appetitions of the mind or soul will be independent of the body, they will nevertheless correspond precisely to the actions of the particular body to which is attached and perfectly conformity to all other substances in the world. Of course, this is really interesting because you've got sympathetic neurons and your body mapped is inside your brain. So I think he's true. All of its view to individual substances as belongs only perceptions and appetitions. I really don't know what appetitions mean. And these perceptions and appetitions can be understood to form appetites. So belief, desire, action. Belief, desire, BDI, intent. Okay. In other words, every appetition, such as one could say that at any given time a particular substance was experienced such and such a perception and such a desire, appetition. Indeed, Leibniz's view is given that a substance X has within it individual concept and information of the following sort. X at time T1 will have perception P1 or appetition 1. X at T2 will have perception 2 or apposition 2. So this is like robotic programming. In fact, the proposition is more complex for, as will be shown, a subsequent section of the mind at any moment has an infinity of appetites and perceptions, appetites and perceptions within it, perceptions of everything that is occurring in the universe, but the human mind at least will be truly aware of one thing at a time. For example, the reader of this article could be said to have a temporally ordered series of perceptions, with T1 corresponding to the first sentence, T2 to the second sentence, and also background noise, which is the reader is not directly aware, for example, the sound of an ambulance siren gradually approaching and retreating from T1 to T3. Moreover, the perception and appetitions are generated from within the individual substance itself. That is, Leibniz speaks that perception and appetitions follow naturally from prior perceptions that, and appetitions, and is, in this aspect, after all, that a finite individual substance is causally independent from all other finite created substances. So, essentially, I read this as basic robotic program. The crucial idea is that the body will follow its own laws, the mind will follow its own laws, and there's no true influence between the two. The mind and the body thus seems to constitute, as it were, worlds apart, as indeed Leibniz claims later when he explains the world in terms of monads. And these worlds are, according to Leibniz, unified solely by virtue of correspondence of their actions and perceptions. Further to these separate realms, there will apply two distinct means of explaining the events of the world. We may explain things according to the final causes of the mind or according to the efficient cause of the body or bodies in general. Thus, not only do the mind and body each seem to follow different sets of laws, but the world, according to Leibniz, can be described in terms of either sets of laws. I will have to stop here because I've got 4.5 and we're going. It's an extra page in a bit, and I don't have enough time to do it. But it is really interesting. It's more of like psychology, social science, and real science in here. So I see a lot of valid points in here. I wouldn't chuck them completely out as many people do. Oh, you got it wrong. He's not Newton. Thanks a lot for listening. Another story comes to a close.
It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.